Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. This is PPTS, presented as a service to the progressive community by the Coffee Party USA Radio Network. PPTS highlights the activities, activists, and activism of the progressive movement. Join our host and special guests as we discuss the most interesting and important topics of the day. If you have a cause, an issue, a campaign, or candidacy that you're actively engaged with, please feel free to give us a call at 646-929-2495 and share with us your question or comment. Join the show's co-host and producer, Progressive Patty, in our lively chat. Go to the bottom of this episode page, sign into the chat room, and let us know what you are doing about it. All opinions are welcome. For the Coffee Party USA and Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, welcome to today's show. Please make welcome our host and friend, the Tennessee Progressive.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Progressive Politics with Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia, Tennessee. For the next 2 hours, I will be the Tennessee Progressive, coming to you live, wire by wire, five by five, coast to coast. You're invited to call into today's show. If you would like to make a comment or ask a question relative to today's topics, we'll be glad to put you on the air and give you the space to do that. All opinions are welcome. We ask two rules. First of all, play nice, respect my house. Anything you wouldn't be ashamed to say in front of your grandmother's minister is probably okay here. We'd like to start a conversation with our listeners each and every week. And we are on the Coffee Party Network, and Coffee Party is proud to be the party of the Civility Pledge. If you'd like to know what that is, feel free to go to coffeepartyusa.com. And it'll be on the front page. You'll know the rules before you get here. We also affiliate with the Move to Amend movement, which is at movetoamend.org. You can find out what's going on there and why it is that we believe in Move to Amend, which is an organization dedicated to an amendment to the Constitution, which says that money is not speech. And corporations are not people. We're also affiliated with the NetRoots Radio Network, where you can hear replays of this and each episode of PPTS on Tuesday evenings beginning at 9 p.m. Central Time by going to netrootsradio.com. And on this very page, you can always find the archive shows, or you can look us up on iTunes, either by going to PPTS on your iTunes menu at the bottom. It's international shows. Or going to Coffee Party USA on iTunes and looking us up that way. I'm here with Progressive Patty, who is my co-host and executive producer of the show. And this is the last show of 2013. And today's show is going to have two areas of interest. The first is the yearly roundup for 2013, We're going to talk about some of the things that have happened, not all of them. There are plenty of outlets and newspapers and online blogs and radio shows and television shows and cable shows that are talking about the best and the worst and the most and the least of 2013. But we will hit a few highlights, and we're going to try and do that, especially as it relates to the second topic of today's show, which is where we will begin looking at the third battlefield in the war on the poor, and that is the battle for women. We'll talk about some of the amazing things that are going on right now, both good and bad, regarding women, citizens of our land. And if you'd like to call us, dial 646-929-2495. And you'll get to meet Progressive Patty. And in order to talk on our airwaves, you must have a signed-in name and a telephone number. That avoids some tomfoolery that we got to put up with last week that we will not put up with this week. We want to hear every voice, but we want you to follow our rules as well. And that's that. You can follow the show at the bottom of our show page today. If you can hear my voice, you know where that page is. And our chat room is open. You're welcome to be there as a guest and to comment and to ask questions. If you would like to talk to us on the air, dial 646-929-2495. And Patty will talk to you, get your information, and then press 1. You will need to press 1 after that when you get put in our queue. If I don't know what you want to talk about, it will mean you haven't been screened yet. So you'll have to wait until you're screened in order to be on air. That's a defensive mechanism we put in place for our listeners last week after we kind of got troll bombed by some folks over on 4chan. So instead of us having to ban 73 people at one shot, I'd rather have an opportunity for everyone to speak. I don't necessarily need you to agree with what I say, but I do need you to play nice, and I need you to come prepared. And we won't have a repeat of last week. At the first instance of tomfoolery, you will be cut off our air and you will be banned from the show's telephone lines. So just want to let you know that. Thanks, fair play. I got a Christmas present, which was a new keyboard and a mouse and a new headphone set, which is very powerful. So you'll hear me typing from time to time, but I'd rather type and get the information out to you than worry about you hearing it, okay? Call us at area code 646-929-2495 if you'd like to talk to us about your best and worst of 2013. That's what we're hoping will happen. Not that we'll talk about everybody else's, but that you'll have an opportunity to discuss your roundup for 2013, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we'd also like to ask you if you have a goal, if there's a goal you have for 2014, what that might be. So I think that's the major housekeeping out of the way anyway. If you would like to contact us, you can do that by writing thetennesseeprogressive@gmail.com. The Tennessee Progressive is one word. You can check out our home group over at the Daily Coast by going to dailycoast.com, where we talk about the show's topics. We kind of debrief the show after the show is over. Sometimes we have live hangouts after the show. We won't be doing that today unless something drastically changes in the next 2 hours. But we're looking forward to you. participating with us. This show is here for you. And the idea is that we promote the activist activities and activism of progressives across the country and across the world. So, basically, 2013 has been an interesting year. There's an old Chinese curse that says, may you live in interesting times. We did. We have. We do. We will. You need to know that the 2014 electoral campaigns are in full swing. A lot of campaigns are picking their staffs. If you would like to find a candidate, if you have a candidate that you believe in, I encourage you to volunteer for that candidate and join us in the Progressive Voices movement. Our goal is to establish 200,000 Progressive Voices, one in each precinct in the country, that will be able to represent our views at the precinct level, we hope. We have a program that's getting ready to ramp up to do that, and we have a good start to it. You can hear about that more on tonight at midnight Eastern time at netrootsradio.com when we have Jibber Your Jabber with myself and my sidekick, Wink, and we'll talk about that some. The idea is that if there is a cause, an organization, a position, a situation, a candidacy, or a candidacy, or a candidate that you want to talk about because of what they're doing as progressive, you can do that within 12 blocks of where you live. You don't have to do a lot of it. You don't have to dedicate tons of time to it. But your voice matters. If you're registered and qualified to vote, which is always the first thing, we can take you from I want to help where I live to I want to run for federal office. We have resources and areas and information-packed resource sites that can help you. We'll train you to do the best job possible. So, you know, the show asks every week, what are you going to do about it? Here's a potential answer for everybody that's listening to the show today or may listen to it, you know, whenever today is. So if you would like some information on that, give me a shout at thetennesseeprogressive@gmail.com or tnprogressive, one word, at netrootsradio.com. And we will work very hard to get you engaged. The only thing we ask is that if you are of voting age, that you be both registered and qualified to vote in the precinct where you live in 2014's general election. That is to exercise the franchise to engage your citizenship. Let 2014 be the year of the citizen. Okay. Man, these adverts and things just keep wonderfully getting longer and longer, don't they? Cool. All right, so 2013. Okay, you've had a chance to think about it. What does 2013 mean for you? It's worth taking a minute back. You know, if you want to know how long ago it was. Think of the first George Zimmerman trial and the shooting of Trayvon Martin. All that we've had to talk about was Stand Your Ground laws, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the Koch brothers, 2013 election cycle, where a lot of local elections went to Libertarian or Tea Party members at the state and local levels, which is one of the things that we have to do something about. And we've learned a lot in 2013 about how those operations work and how it is that they spend hundreds of millions of dollars to buy state houses and courthouses and school districts. Of course, we had a jump start to that with Newtown and Aurora and other places, and we got to engage in some important conversations, and we'll continue to engage in important conversations about gun control and Second Amendment, NSA, and the Fourth Amendment. The desire and active attempt by a small minority of the minority party to actually create what many called acts of sedition against the United States government by shutting down the United States government. If you're reading today's blogosphere and you're reading that Senator Ted Cruz says that he's really thinking that it was a terrible mistake for President Obama to shut down the government, you might want to call me on that and have a chat, because President Obama did not shut down the government. And it's all over the blogosphere. It's certainly all over the talking head shows today. So we're writing about that, and we're talking about that so that we can get the record straight. One of the primary functions of Tea Party and Republican politics is put the lie out there and then make them prove us wrong. Make them pay enough to prove us wrong. And it's terribly difficult for us to have the opportunity to talk about important things when we're being consistently distracted. So one of the things I'd like to say that we can do in 2014 is that we will ignore the distractions and continue talking as loudly as we can about the truth, because when you speak truth to power, we believe that's when things change. We had a lot of conversation about Benghazi. Fox News is busy saying that President Obama's handshake with Raul Castro is the moment that everyone will talk about from the Mandela funeral. If that's the case, then we do Mandela a terrible disservice. And, of course, as badly as they want that to be the truth, it's not the truth. The truth is there was a celebration of the life of a man who single-handedly changed a nation and thereby changed the world. I want to focus on that for a minute because so many people believe there's nothing they can do. Now, one man went to jail for 27 years because of what he believed. He became the president of his country, and he changed hundreds of years of political reality and governmental reality for millions of people. Of course, some of those people didn't like it, but what they decided was that the majority had spoken. That's something a lot of people in this country have yet to agree to. If one believes that the central core business of government is governance of the people and responding to the needs of the nation, as I do, and then one sees the terrible but yet effective way that the opposition party has made it virtually, not virtually, but nearly impossible to govern at all by creating gridlock at every turn, there comes a point at which reasonable people say, which is it? When you have honest disagreement over an issue, that's one thing. When you try to govern in spite of duly held elections, that's something else. And when you try to turn over the government so that you can undo the sitting majority to have your way, that's something else again. There's been a lot of talk this week about rights. There's been a lot of talk in this year of 2013 about rights. Who has them? Who should have them? Who doesn't? We talked about education. We talked about health care. We talked about the unemployed who are back in the news this week thanks to that same recalcitrant minority. These are issues at the kitchen table. There are still 76 million Americans who don't have shelter security. 18% of those are children who don't have food security. We have graduates or college students who are looking, the millennials who are in college right now, looking for their shot at the American dream, hoping that there's a level playing field for them when they graduate either in January or May. The unemployment numbers are better than they were. The economy is still in recovery, has been since January of 2009. And all across America, in virtually any category of citizen you'd like to name, there has been an ongoing battle. What we believe America is supposed to be, which is good for any nation to have that conversation. One of the things you might not understand is that there are very few nations where such discussions are even allowed, much less allowed in public, without some really serious implications. One of the things we talked about was the inequalities among us, the 1% versus the 0.1% versus the 99%. As the wealth distribution gap continues to compress, or if you prefer, expand, the distance between the haves and the have-nots is growing, but the number of have-nots is also growing. So that's how it's both compressed and expanded. One cannot imagine a worse situation, but there are worse situations that America has, in fact, persevered through. This one, like the one most people would reference as a comparison to this time, is the Great Depression of 1929. And there are many, many similarities between the causations of that depression and this one. I don't call this a recession. I call it a depression. And I think it's just a recession at this point is a publicly figured better name for reality. I want to talk about reality. And in 2013, we had an awful lot of opportunity to talk about reality. It is important to understand that in the nature of a federally constituted democratic republic, which is what we are, there's always the possibility of change. The question is whether or not that change should exist and to what purpose. You know, there's when someone starts their conversation, if we're not a democracy, we're a republic, I have virtually nothing else to say to them because it's not true. We are a federally constituted, which means we work under a constitution, democratic republic. Among our several states, we have one voice. And we have the voice that attends to all the people. Among our several states, the republic side, we all have participation in the working of government. That's the democratic side. And those who say we're not a democracy, we're a republic, say so because they believe that there's no such thing as all of us. I have, of course, a problem with that. I believe that there is an all of us. And from the worst of us to the best of us, we all are in it together. And that's the conversation I want to have regarding 2013, as well as the battlefield for women. 2013 was known by a large degree as the war on women, the year of the war on women. More anti-women legislation in terms of reproductive rights, health care, voting rights, voter suppression, economic rights, criminal justice rights, any number of areas that you might talk about, came to the forefront in 2013. It was a continuation of 2012, but it really got ugly in 2013. And it became so bad that there were those who for a long time had been holding back in their desire to be so arrogant and blisteringly casual about their hatred for women that broke open in 2013 because of a perceived permission that didn't exist. And what they couldn't do at the national level, they really got a surprise when the pushback was so hard. So we're seeing an increase in anger. We're seeing an increase in anti-Semitism and open hatred, contracting hatred to the point that it's becoming hardened. And the Bible says that they will harden their hearts. There's a lot of heart hardening going on. And everything we're doing is trying to release that hardness. One of the reasons that people feel so hard-hearted is because they feel that no one's listening to them. Women, in particular. And at the same time, we had the October Revolution, when someone decided that a dysfunctioning web page was suddenly the end of government as we knew it, one way or the other. We had the NSA situation with Edward Snowden. ACA rolled out. And just so you know, as an update, the Affordable Care Act signups in December are well over 2 million. The total top 6 million, and it's growing. That is suddenly turning, like Benghazi and other things, into a non-issue. As much as Republicans have decried and bemoaned the presence of the Affordable Care Act as being the work of a socialist Marxist who is of a single mind to become a dictator over the American people, they're also talking about the man they refused to talk to more than 20 times before, you know, after he had said, "I will not negotiate the good faith and credit of the American government or the good auspices of the American people for a political end," and said it again because of what's liable to come up in January concerning the debt limit increase. Of course, Fox is now filled with people who are saying that's a fake. Yeah, it's as fake as the last one was, guys. You would be well advised not to mistake that one again. There's a lot of bickering going on back and forth from Rush Limbaugh, you know, decrying on his radio show that the Tea Party shall rise again, to hopes that in the new year we'll hear a different tune, that we will be able to come together and talk and have some governance of the people. I think this non-governmental stuff is just about done, and I hope so. So, when we look at the battle for women, we have to understand that it is the third battlefield in the war on the poor. And one of the ways that we look at that war is through the lens of womanhood. What has actually been going on around women in 2013, at the state level certainly, and with attempts at the federal level, is most likely going to continue, and you're going to see it in a certain number of ways, and those are some of the ways we're going to look at over the next three shows. But there's also some good news concerning equality rights for women in health care and education and finance. Equality as citizens and voter suppression and things like that that I want you to look for. And if you're a woman in America, I want you to become engaged. I want you to become registered and qualified to vote. And I want you to become engaged in the process because you represent more citizenship or citizenry than men do. And whether you're black or white or Latino or poor or a student or a single mom, you must engage your own democracy now. Unfortunately, what the plan was so effective that many people didn't notice that 38 states became supermajority Republican in their state houses. And therefore, we get this 2013 rise of statehood and statecraft and separation of state and all that sort of stuff. And of course, it's rattling a saber, but it's also poisoning the well. And, you know, the big thing right now is to talk about 2013 is the worst year of President Obama's presidency. I challenge that because of the successes that the presidency has had, which has virtually changed the shape of the nation. Now, there have been changes to the shape of this nation. Not all the changes that everybody wanted, and certainly not all the changes that women were hoping for. Some of the changes were those that women decidedly hoped against. When Texas, for instance, decided it was going to end its Medicaid program, it targeted women because women are by nature more susceptible to the needs of health care than men are. When women get sick, men die. Women have babies. Women normally take their children to the doctor when their children are ill. The male doesn't. That may be because they're single moms and the man's not there, or it may be that the mom is a stay-at-home mom, and when the kids get sick, she's there for her children. And there may not be someone else available to take them to see the doctor or to the emergency room, and it befalls to the woman, the mom, to take that role, which, you know, is arguably a better role for a woman to have, but I don't... There are women who choose to stay at home to raise their children, and we have a Family Medical Leave Act that allows them to do that, or we did, and that is now being expanded. And I know that because I pay attention to the legislative calendar, and it's available at thomas.gov, and you too can see the legislation that's being proposed or is being entered into the register, and follow it on anything, whether it be medical reproductive rights or abortion or women's health or women's economic issues. These things are all available. It doesn't make sense that when these bills come up to vote in the House of Representatives or in the Senate, that be the first time you as a citizen hear of them. We want you to be engaged at your local level. We want you to write letters to your Congress critter. We want you to write letters to the editor and simply let your position be known. Tell your story. Everybody has a story. We'll teach you, even if you want to, we can teach you how to do a real story of self and a story of now and a story of us, which is going to be the focus of the engagement campaigns that we participate in and coordinate with in the 2014 electoral cycle. It's important that, you know, they used to call it retail politics, where you can see somebody face to face and press the flesh and grip and grin and all that. We want you to be that face. We want you to go to your neighbors and say, you know, I believe in, I'm in favor of, I'm working for, just where you live. If you do that, we've got it made. There's a lot of talk that the Democratic brand is under the gun right now. Nothing could be further from the truth. Democrats, as far as I'm concerned, have nothing to apologize for, with the possible exception of Republicans. And the Republicans are finding themselves in a difficult situation with the likes of Ted Cruz and others, who can't seem to keep their mouth shut long enough to let their philosophy and their ideology make their argument for them. When the argument becomes about a person, the argument's over. And, of course, Senator Ted Cruz knows that. So he's trying, he and Sarah Palin and others, Daryl Issa, who we got a lot of in 2013. We saw a lot of racism in 2013 as well. One of the ways that we saw that, not the only way, but one of the ways we saw that was in voter suppression and voter rights and voter ID card requirements and, you know, other crazies. We saw the most outrageous words for those who believe in marriage equality spouted out into the American airwaves and printed word and written word with the Duck Dynasty fiasco and Chick-fil-A and all those others when they decided that LGBT equality was something that most people agree with, that few people hate enough to be abusively arrogant about. And this is not the way that we were taught to be citizens, but some people have been told that it's okay for their hatred to show arrogantly and even casually, like, you know, what's somebody going to do about it? Well, this show was one of the answers to that. And we give rise to the opportunity for those of whatever position you hold to be a part of the conversation. We know that there are those who disagree with us, and that's perfectly fine. We know that it is important that we as a nation understand and come together in 2014 to make some basic value judgments about what democracy's continuing purpose is. And we, you know, there are those who want to dissemble the Constitution of the United States. There are those who want to change the form of government of the United States into a corporatist plutocratic theocracy, which is very close to what we're having at the moment, because big money is showing its power in the fact that it is keeping the elected president of the United States from governing. It is encouraging a Congress of Senate and House Republicans to not show up to the table to do their job. And of course, you know, I'm an old Kentucky hillbilly. It makes sense to me that you're paid for your work, but if you don't work, you don't get paid. And to then say that we're going to shut down the government, well, we're going to keep those who shut down the government's paychecks going, I didn't like that much. I thought if you're going to stand on that principle, live it. You're asking people, 800,000 federal employees, to go without pay. Why don't you? And as one sainted Republican said, I can't afford not to work. I get to get paid. I got a house and a mortgage to keep. I got kids in college. And, you know, we had our moment of pity for him. It wasn't like 74 million Americans couldn't say the same thing. But evidently, because he's special, he gets a reprieve. It wasn't even that was so bad. It was the casual arrogance of it all. You know, I heard women say last year, well, you know, you guys aren't really looking out for us. You're just looking out for your own votes. Well, I got to tell you something. There's a different way of looking at that, okay? It could be that we're getting the votes because of the way we're doing the work. We being Democrats, liberals, progressives, as opposed to Republicans, conservatives, ultra-conservative, fundamentalists, and Tea Party terrorists. And if you can understand anything in opposition to what the progressives are talking about, specifically on this show, which is called Progressive Politics, you can understand that your conservatism has pretty much destroyed your party. Your party is in the middle of a meltdown. That meltdown is gasoline that is being lit on a continual basis by a very small minority within your party. You need to address that, and you need to do it at the polls. I don't have any notion at all that the Republican Party should not exist. I think it should. I think there are significant issues with good voices that make sense within the confines of the Republican Party. Unfortunately, it's terribly difficult to find them right now because they've all been co-opted, those voices, by a very small minority who don't want governance, who don't want power. They want to destroy the government of the United States. That is their stated purpose. That is their stated purpose. And anyone who would say otherwise is certainly free to call me at 646-929-2495. And if you can make it through the screening process, come on my air and talk to me about it. I'd love to hear from you. There were some terrible things which happened in 2013. There were some pretty cool things that happened, too. And I think it's only fair that we remember that there were some good things that happened. But what I really want to talk about, I don't want to be stuck talking about what nationally or statewide bad, terrible, ugly, shame on them things happened in 2013. I want you to call me and tell me your story of 2013. What was your worst and best moment of 2013? How do you see 2013 from the standpoint of being a woman and perhaps in a minority, perhaps as an unemployed minority woman with health care issues or education issues or hunger issues or housing issues? How do you think that climate change or global warming is going to affect you as a woman in the United States in 2014? Now, it seems that there are those who are already making their way toward the podium for the 2014 election cycle by acting like 2016 presidential candidates. And on the Democratic side, there are those who want us to believe that it's a shoo-in that Hillary Clinton is going to run and then win the presidential nomination on the Democratic side. And that's not necessarily true, first of all, because Ms. Clinton may well decide that she doesn't want to run. And we talk about energy resources, and, you know, for the first time in a long time, the United States government consumed more of its own oil than oil from other places. And we have to talk about the deportation of children and parents. We have to talk about fracking quakes and other things like that over the next 3 weeks. I want to talk about them as a representation of their effect on the females of the land, the women of this country. And hopefully next week we're going to spend time with one of the most active among them, who is going to give us an update on her organization's efforts. And I'm going to make that as a teaser and not tell you who I'm talking about. I will tell you over the course of the 3 weeks, we're likely to hear from some of the most powerful women in American politics today. And invite you to listen to us, respond to us, send in your questions to one word, the Tennessee Progressive at gmail.com, that you would like to ask the most influential female in American political life today. And over the course of 3 weeks, we'll pick, somewhere between 5 and 10 of them to ask all of our guests. So you can come up with your entry for the most important question to ask any woman involved in American political life in 2014. What would it be? What is the one question that you most desperately need an answer to? We found out that Virginia was available to a potentially reasonable Democratic takeover in 2013, and that could extend itself into 2014. We hope that it does, for the sake of the elimination of the transvaginal ultrasound 20-week abortion bill that Governor Ultrasound forced upon Virginia's Commonwealth. And among the violence that we saw worldwide, when you're dealing with nations that are killing their own citizens in the tens of hundreds and tens of hundreds, it's kind of hard to look at whether or not women should be afforded the right to have responsibility over their own reproductive systems. But wars have been fought for less. Nations have risen and fallen for less. One of the things that 2013 showed us is that there are some things that are really, really, really important to somebody. The question is, are they important enough to us all to come together and compromise to a solution that moves us all forward, taking most of our desires with us in success and some that we have to come back in later and fight again for? The conversation should continue, and it shouldn't continue with my voice being the only participant. So give me a call if you're willing to play nice and let us know what you think the best and worst events of 2013 were for you, and maybe what you plan to accomplish or achieve in 2014, whether that is merely the continuation of survival or maybe not living under a bridge, but maybe, you know, getting a restart in life. I know people who are doing that, and there are people who are fighting every day to stay alive, to keep their families going, to keep them together, to maintain their jobs, to keep getting a paycheck. Although, today is the day, well, yesterday actually was the day, that many millions of Americans discovered that the pay that they had been receiving wasn't in their mailbox. And that, of course, was the elimination of the benefits of unemployment for several millions of Americans who had not quite the Merry Christmas you did. And to me personally, and I will admit this freely, openly to anybody who cares to know, I remember those people. I know that there are people who had fantastically extravagant, luxurious Christmases, and I'm proud as punch for them. I really am. I'm glad. And I'll say this again. I don't know anyone in my political stripe who wants to take wealth away from anyone. No one. They just want the same shot. They want a fair playing field, a level playing field. If you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth and you inherit great wealth, God bless you. Good luck to you. There are just as many problems with those folks as there are those who are fighting for a meal today. They're different problems. They're not less. They're not more. They're just different. And, you know, we believe that the rich help the rich and the poor help the poor. That's not true. There are many, many people of great wealth who spend a lot of money and a lot of their time trying to make things better at the bottom of the social scale. It's a little bit more difficult to do your part to help a suffering wealthy person. But that's not because of anything other than the people that they are versus the person that you are. I believe that a rising tide lifts all boats, and I believe that as long as one of us is not free, then none of us is free, whether we be, you know, slave or free. We can be enslaved different ways. And when we're enslaved to the point that it falls upon us to have to accept some abnormal condition, then we all suffer. And when you have a family with kids that's living in a car, eating their daily meals by grazing at Walmart, not able to go to school, not able to get a reasonably nutritious meal at school, we as a nation then have a problem. And for those who are not yet certain, I will tell you that I believe in corporate citizenship. I believe that if a company is going to do business in America, that it needs to be not only a reasonable corporate citizen, but an outstanding example-setting corporate citizen. and many of our corporations live that creed every single day. Many of them do not. We have enough money hidden in offshore accounts by corporations to eliminate the deficit right now, with plenty of money left over, if they would but pay the legitimate taxes that are due the United States government. If we would eliminate the corporate loopholes which make it possible for them to see billions of profit, but we will not give aid and comfort to the least among us. The money that was taken from the SNAP program could well be included in that number easily, if those taxes that were legitimately owed to the United States were paid. We wouldn't have to cut the SNAP program. But you see, I think there's a further nefarious purpose to that, and it has nothing to do with a shortage of money, which is where I begin to have a problem. Should we provide for those who cannot provide for themselves? 2013 saw an awful lot of discussion about that. And the two primary voices were yes and no. There wasn't a lot of I don't knows, which can sometimes take place. When a woman is looking at her hungry child, there's no question in her mind. When a man is looking at his job, generally, you know, it doesn't come across as a problem that he has to deal with because he has to save his job. Because historically, culturally, American men are income providers. And, of course, a lot of women would tell you that if their man were income providing, they wouldn't have to work. In the 70s, we decided it was cool for women to work, that they were, you know, perfectly willing and capable of working in peacetime, and they should have the rights to their own careers, their own identities, their own professionalism. And we basically established the two-income family. And, of course, we also established raging credit and mounting debt at both the family and national level. Businesses thought it was perfectly okay to outspend their income by several tens of percentage points, to refuse to provide those benefits that companies since the beginning of time in America have always provided for their employees because somehow they didn't have to. We bought into a lie that says the purpose of corporations is profit to the bottom line for their shareholders, which is not now nor has ever been the truth. We have allowed corporations and companies in our communities to escape from the community guidelines that we set for every other member of our community, while at the same time corporations have been screaming that they're people too, that they have all the rights of personhood. They don't. They aren't. And until one corporation does time, you're going to convince me. So, you know, if I see a corporation bleeding on the street, I'll help him like I will anybody else. Until I do, don't come knocking on my door. I've worked in some of the largest corporations in America. I know how they act. I run my own businesses. I know how they act. And I love hiring passionate, dedicated, determined, innovative, creation, solution-oriented people to work on my teams. But I'm not going to tell them that I count and they don't, because to me, that is completely nonsensical. I'm not going to say that I have a right to one thing that you, because of your, you know, your sexual gender, are not entitled to. Or because of your sexual orientation, you need to be considered to be a second-class citizen. There is no second-class citizen. Not in America. We don't have a caste system. We don't have a class system. We may be living what would appear to be one, but it's not real. It's one manufactured artificially by those who would have us believe otherwise. Yet, we know, and certainly I know, from years and decades of political activism, that when you speak truth to power, things change. Sometimes you have to speak truth to power simply to stop the evils the lie generates. And, of course, there's been a lot of talk about that this year, too. So, if you want to see what's possible, look at a child. If you want to know what's not possible, look somewhere else. Children are by nature the most optimistic, the most creatively oriented, the most meaningful possibilities of tomorrow. And our job as adults is to make them survivable to the point where they can exist on their own. First time in a very long time, American parents are finding that it's entirely possible that their children will not have the same benefits that their parents had. That freedom will mean less to the next generation than it does to this one. Our enduring hope, interestingly enough, is in the millennials, those who look at things from a more universal scale, who are not so tied to philosophical, political dogma, but look at things from a reality standpoint, you know, who more tend to follow the mantra of don't tell me what you believe. I'll watch you for 24 hours and then tell you what you believe. From religions and other faith groups to political organizations to education systems to healthcare systems to justice systems, you know, it's a nation of realism. And unfortunately, the problem with economic depression is that you trade optimism for realism. And if it gets bad enough, you trade realism for fatalism. Optimism says, yes, we can. Realism says, yes, we are. Fatalism says, we never will. That's the simple fact of it. And we don't like that fact a lot. It's not necessarily how you were brought up, but how you were brought up can come to play in that. There are historical, social, and cultural realities within the family network or the non-family network for those millions of teens in America who are living on the street by their own devices because they don't have a parental or family network for one reason or another to inform them as they go. A lot of fear puts up a wall. And all of a sudden we have these terrible conversations about doing away with public education or food stamps. While those at the very top, you know, it's interesting because those folks win either way. They can't lose. They have reached and surpassed the ultimate of the American dream that they can cancel it out. And while I do not begrudge them their wealth, I begrudge many of them their attitude. We got a clear sign of that in the 2012 election. Going forward into 2013, it's still here. In Tennessee, we're going to start dealing in January with a governor who seems to have created quite a bit of wealth for himself at the expense of the citizens of the state of Tennessee. And you'll be hearing more about that, I guarantee you. Meanwhile, those things which could make life better for all of Tennessee, he has pretty much done nothing about. He and his state senate president, his lieutenant governor, and his chief executives have not been much interested in looking at the concerns, needs, and desires of the average person in the state of Tennessee, but rather to those to whom he has either alleged his allegiance or is trying to buy favor with. It's going to be an explosive situation in 2014. And the folks of Tennessee are going to have to cover that. We did a lot of that in 2013 across all the battles and battlefields in the war on the poor. And we didn't do such a bang-up job. We didn't really stop anything. 2014 is going to stop a lot of things, I hope. I hope you'll help us. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the 2013 year, its role as it played out for women, and what you can do about it. You're listening live to Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style. I am the Tennessee Progressive. We'll be back just after the flip.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. There are many arguments proclaiming the evils of big government, and it always seems to come back to the same arguments made by the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists during the days of our founders concerning the differences between a strong central government and a weak central government. The Second Continental College adopted the Articles of Confederation on November 15, 1777, and it was in place until 1789. But it was replaced by the Constitution, which advocated for a stronger central government. Why was it replaced? The Articles of Confederation maintained the principle that the national government would not hold more power than the states, that which they saw as sovereign. This satisfied the fears that many of the states had regarding a strong central power, as Britain was before the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there was no executive branch, because they feared giving one man that much power, and it was decided that the Congress would handle all the nation's affairs. However, there were many inherent weaknesses with the Articles of Confederation. The national government did not have the power to tax. Congress did not have the power to force states to obey its laws. Congress could not enforce laws. Each state could issue its own paper money. Any state could put tariffs on trade between other states or countries. There was no system of national courts. Congress could declare war and raise an army, but it could not force the states to give men or money. After the Revolutionary War, the country went into a deep post-war depression. The states were threatening war with each other, and there were armed uprisings and riots across the land. Things eventually got so bad that the country was on the verge of a civil war. This was called the critical period. Because each state was printing their own money, the value depreciated soon after the war, and many returning soldiers were paid in currency they considered to be worthless. There are stories that some soldiers wallpapered their house with the paper currency. On May 25, 1787, the Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia to decide the fate of the Articles of Confederation, and on September 17, 1787, a new constitution was approved, which had the much-needed, stronger central powers. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA Blog Talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. The Boston Tea Party is one of the most cherished stories from the founding of our country. This is one of the events that inspired the American colonists to stand up against tyranny imposed on them from the British government. Until 1764, the colonies were allowed self-rule, but with the conclusion of the French and Indian War in 1763, the British were low on money, so they decided to begin enforcing their trade laws to try to increase their capital. The British began to go after smuggling by searching colonial ships and convicting colonists in the British Admiralty courts. This enraged the colonists because the violators weren't given a trial by jury. Also, the British began levying taxes against the colonists on a whole host of articles, as well as tea, from sugar, coffee, stamps, and even dice and playing cards. The British didn't think they were being harsh on the American colonists, but the Americans disagreed. They believed the troops garrisoned in the colonies weren't needed since the French threat had been removed. Why would they want to pay taxes for garrisons that were only there to make sure the American colonists stayed in line? The colonists always received permission in the past from England for levying their own taxes, But now that right was being taken away, and because they didn't have their own representation in the British Parliament, they were being denied their own traditional rights as English subjects. This was going too far. In regards to the Tea Act, the British government gave the East India Company permission to transport tea, duty-free, from Great Britain to America to sell. Because they didn't have to pay the duty, it meant they could undersell the American merchants who sold tea, which would monopolize the tea trade. This would drive many colonists out of work. The Bostonians felt that something had to be done. If they allowed the tea to land and be offloaded, then the British would have had a moral victory in that the colonists were finally paying the tax they created for them. Also, there were many Tories, those still loyal to England, which would have had no problem with buying the tea. Destroying the tea seemed to be their only option. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA blog talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone. Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. It is a time for the muckrakers to return. In the early 20th century, writers, photographers, and journalists stepped up to expose the injustices of their day. Back then, anything could be done to make a profit at the expense of the workers and the consumers. Among some of the practices were farmers being charged unfair rates by the railroad industry to move their produce, packing industries that didn't concern themselves with health and safety issues, and deplorable working conditions were being placed upon the workers at many factories, including the children that were also working as laborers. At the same time, there were many local, state, and federal elected leaders that were profiting by allying themselves with these industries at the expense of the public. Theodore Roosevelt used the term muckraker when he delivered his "The Man with the Muckrake" speech on April 15, 1906 in Washington, D.C. He stated, "In Pilgrim's Progress, the man with the muckrake is set forth as an example of him whose vision is fixed on carnal instead of spiritual things. Yet he also typifies the man who in this life consistently refuses to see the aught that is lofty and fixes his eyes with solemn intentness on that which is vile and debasing. Now it is very necessary that we should not flinch from seeing what is vile and debasing. There is filth on the floor, and it must be scraped up with a muckrake. And there are times and places where this service is the most needed of all the services that can be performed. Today, a muckraker has become known as someone that searches out and publicly exposes real or apparent misconduct of a prominent individual or business. But this kind of reporting has been playing second fiddle to the sensational 24/7 style of reporting being employed by the cable networks today. Tactics that strive to get the most profit at the expense of everyone else hasn't disappeared. And with today's social media and the ability of everyone to be citizen journalists, the need for the muckraker to expose these practices is more important than ever, so they can be held in check once and for all." Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA blog talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin, host of the Coffee Party Radio's Civics Minute. Did you know that the Coffee Party is funded by our listeners and fans, and not by the super PACs, think tanks, or by a super wealthy individual wanting to buy the American way? The Coffee Party USA is powered by the people and your passion to bring positive change to our country, but we need your help to continue. With just a small donation, you can help us continue bringing Americans together for a dialogue that attempts to bypass the normal partisan rhetoric that is so common today. The Coffee Party USA is striving to bring you original content from editorials, fact-checking, and video documentaries, while also working to bring you the latest information from all of the 535 congressional districts. No matter what party we may belong or what issues that we follow, one thing is always clear. We are all Americans. Please go to coffeepartyusa.nationbuilder.com/donate and donate what you can to help us move our country forward, united with one voice, E Pluralist Unum. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin.
Welcome back to Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style. I am the Tennessee Progressive, and we're coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia, on this, the last Sunday of the year 2013, December 29th, 2013. And we're talking about the year of 2013 and what it means to you. I'd like you to call me at 646-929-2495. And tell me, what was your best and worst of 2014? This year has been an amazing one for a lot of different reasons, for a lot of different people. And I know that in my case, my best of 2013 is right now, because I have made it this far in 2013 on what has not been, I think, one could reasonably say, an easy journey, but one that has been done. It has not been done alone. I've had help from people who have mightily shown up and shown off on my behalf alone, selflessly. I have care workers that work for me to my benefit and my ease every single day of the week. I have friends that look out for my best interest even when I am their biggest obstacle to them. And I am blessed in many, many ways that the life I am allowed to lead today is not one that I could create for myself. And I want to publicly thank those people for making my this year a year of living, more than a year of being a patient. So to the team, to those people who care for me every day, know that you are considered to be angels on my shoulder, and I appreciate you very, very much. The worst of 2013 has been, I had a number of medical issues to deal with that required hospitalization on several occasions, some of which were more involved in others. I got to take at-home antibiotics in 2013 for the first time and saw some of the advancements that have been made in medical science and technology directly attributable to the battlefield. I got to use a antibiotic medicine ball for the first time. I don't know if you all know what those are, but they're really cool. You can put them in your pocket, and there's a little motor on the IV line that pushes the antibiotics into your body. And it's really cool because you don't have to walk around with an IV hanging off a pole and all that sort of stuff. And that's the whole point of what everything around here is involved in my world, is making it possible for me to be a person instead of a patient. So I was really thrilled with that. I'm always thrilled when I got it. And for the first time in 2013, for the first time since 2006, I went to the hospital and was not admitted. I got to come home. So that was a first. That was a pretty good day too. I've had a lot of friends do wonderful things this year. I've got three staff assistants who work very hard to make sure that their daddy is well provided for. Those are my three feline friends and my companions, whom I love dearly. And for a dog guy, that's quite a lot to say. I've written a lot this year on the Daily Kos and on my writing site, my professional writing site. About 1.5 million words have come out of my hand this year. And that is productive. That is me being productive. I've also worked with four radio shows this year, either my own or others. And I've met a ton of wonderful people online on the airwaves. And we've associated with the Coffee Party USA for this show, Progressive Politics. And I want to thank Annabelle Park and Eric Byler for that privilege. And to all my fellow show hosts at Coffee Party, we're doing a good job. We're doing it right for the right reason. Please keep doing it. It's terribly important that you understand that in the middle of all the noise that's going on in political life, you know, we like to say within the beltway, but that's really not true, because the political reality of political life is that politics expands across the nation and in many cases across the world. And it's absolutely true that we've had ample evidence of that in this year with the National Security Agency and the Edward Snowden case and Bradley Manning as well. I have not offered my opinions on either of those, any of those issues. We do have members of the Coffee Party who have, and have either been hurrahed or hoisted as a result of it. And the one thing that I think the Coffee Party strives to do in a very real way is to begin a civil conversation where those of disparate views can come together and peaceably discuss civilly their disagreements. That's not universally true. It is something that we and within this environment try to ensure. So please don't feel that you need to agree with me to talk to me. The only thing I ask is that you respect me, simply because I'm giving you the opportunity to get your voice and your opinion out to the world. That's something you don't run into every day. So I'd appreciate it if you would be civil, if you would be respectful. You play nice, in other words, and you come prepared. If you'd like to, you know, state your opinion, put a big box around it, say it's yours, rip, let it rip, go for it. If you want to present a factual circumstance or a factual case, be prepared. Back it up. We will. And, of course, I live in a political world. I always have. I've not known a moment in my life when I was not involved in one way or the other in some political thing or another. And I've had plenty of reasons not to and plenty of opportunities not to. And I've taken those opportunities from time to time, but it has come back to me. I don't know why. I'm not particularly good at it, but I'm in there swinging. And you may disagree with me. You may not like it, but I'm in there swinging for what I believe in. And the thing that I believe in is that every argument, when reduced to the level of the citizen, is vital. I don't want to talk about parties. I don't want to talk about politics as ideology or philosophy. I want to talk about the implications of the political life upon the citizens of this country and upon the citizens of the world. I think that's an important conversation to have, so much so that I started a radio show about it called Progressive Politics with Tennessee Style. Progressive politics is the nature of this conversation, but Tennessee Style is the way that conversation is carried out. We do tend to be genteel in this part of the woods, and we do tend to be respectful, and we ask you to do the same. But your voice is most welcome here. 2013 was a continuation of 2012 and the assault on women. We saw nationally there was a lot of talk about the war on women, and we decided that we were going to posit an opposite view in my world and talk about the war for women. We were going to talk about the things that were being done in behalf of women. And, of course, our conversation was a lot less on ours and a lot more on theirs because there were so many acts of incivility toward women in the United States in 2012, and it carried through to 2013. In 2012, there were 908 state legislative bills introduced to restrict the rights of women. In 2013, there were over 1,100. Everything from voting rights to reproductive rights to women's health to women, economic and criminal and social justice issues, environmental justice issues, it went across the board. Now, as a Democrat and as a progressive, I tend to look at social issues with a bit of a jaundiced eye. They are more important to me. They have been more important to me in my life than other issues like wealth creation and industrialization and international politics and things like that. That doesn't mean that I'm not aware of them. It means that I tend to choose the focus of my work on social issues. That's where, you know, when you talk about environmental justice, you get called a tree hugger. Or when you talk about social justice issues, you get called lots of things. And there have been veterans issues, police issues, fire issues, nurse issues, public options issues, public unions, private unions, industrial incorporated issues that have taken place on the forefront of the political scene in 2013 that we have begun to rise up to address. That is only beginning. The ability that Republicans and conservatives and Tea Party terrorists want to give us is that those conversations are over and everything's going to be fine. They're hoping against hope that that's the truth, even as they realize in the fullness of reality that it is not. These conversations are just beginning, and the damage that these folks have done to democracy in the name of personal pride and wealth issues are going to continue for a very long time. And if I have anything to say about it, they're going to continue for indeed a very long time. We have to address this this inequity that we have allowed to persist on our democracy as citizens. We have schools under armed guard. We have businesses that sell death. We have portrayed ourselves as a nation across the world in a light that is not advantageous or necessarily positive for ourselves. And a lot of that has to do with the rest of the world watching us with shock and awe as they see what it takes to be a true democracy and saying, if that's what it takes, we don't want it. Thank you very much. We would rather be oppressed and know it than to be told we're liberated and know that to be a lie. There is a fragile economy that is holding its own barely right now in the United States. We have seen growth consistently, but at a very small rate since January of 2009. The rest of the world has not necessarily recovered to even the degree that we have, and there are several nations around the world who are in financial meltdown, even as we speak. What is it to lose a nation? Women know the answer to that question a lot easier and a lot more readily than men do, because their access and permission or recognition for participation in the democratic process has been minimized in many ways, in many places. And what I don't understand, of course, I don't understand why the people of Detroit, Michigan are not in the streets, because they've lost their democracy to an individual who seems to think that it's perfectly okay to take that from them. I don't understand that. I admit it readily. I don't understand that. So I'd like an answer. I'd like an answer to the question. But I want to make the conversation possible, because to me, that's the conversation that matters. I admit I don't know all the sides of all the issues. I am pretty well read on most of them. But I can tell you where the party stands. I can tell you where, you know, individuals by their statements stand. But I can't explain the why of a lot of things. And I'd like to have a conversation where I could come to understand some of the whys of some of the things. Why do women vote in their own self against their own self-interest? Why do minorities vote against their own self-interest? Why is it that they feel that rejection is acceptable? We talk about white privilege. I'm a white male. I don't know that I've ever known white privilege. But if white privilege emits simply because of the fact that I was born white and a male, it's a privilege that I've never knowingly participated in. I don't see myself as being more worthy or less worthy than anybody on the planet. I'm filled with failures and sins and failings and faults, and that's part of the human condition. You have them too. And we are not a perfect people. We are not a perfect nation. We are an experiment that is 200 and nearly 40 years old now. Last year, it was put to the test. And as was the case, joyously I will admit, democracy won. And it was because we had a president who was willing to stand up to political tomfoolery and say, enough. He said it for women. He said it for men. He said it for the poor. He said it for the rich. He said it for the oppressed. And America finally agreed with him. It galled a lot of people to have to do it, but even they could not support and endorse the activities their political organizations were putting up. Meanwhile, those who are the true nefarious agents, agent provocateur, who want to undo democracy, had a field day. They just had a field day. And they took the will of the people and beat it down with money. The NRA is a prime example of that. They protected their vested interest very well. And there's some conversation in 2013 that got started about gun control and gun safety legislation and things like that that the president endorsed that didn't get it up, didn't get out of the barn, because the only thing that happened was there was enough money applied to shut up the opposition. And that money came pouring in by the hundreds of millions of dollars across the land, not because of the Second Amendment, mind you, lest anyone be fooled. That had nothing to do with it. It was sold that way, and an awful lot of people, including women, bought that line. It wasn't true. It was false at the outset. And we have to understand that as we are citizens, you know, men are used to looking after their women, or maybe not. Women are used to being looked after, or maybe not. And what we have said is that we want people to talk to us in a conversation about the things that matter most to them, what their issues are. That would be much to talk about. And we have someone who evidently would like to talk about it from Michigan, area code 518. You are live and on the air. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Bud.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Joe Pomponio, and I'm up in Albany, New York.
You're in Albany. Okay. I know you now. Go ahead.
I'm kind of missing in action, so I'm a little new, I guess, to you, to format has changed, and as I told the lady when I just called in, I've had a real bad year, to say the least. But to move on to, I guess, my number one problem for the year of 2013, at the top would be media coverage, mainly because all the other things that bother me, that I have concerns with, they're like a show. It's like watching reality TV. Now, I'm fully aware MSNBC is basically Democratic and progressive. I'm in that category, but I like to be independent. Fox News is Republican-owned. I got that. So you've got CNN and Bloomberg. CNN is starting to get a little problematic for me. My number one stations are turning out to be Free Speech TV and, believe it or not, Al Jazeera News.
Yeah.
That's on Fine Network. There's a couple others. But down to the reporting end of this, it's a responsibility, I believe, of the media, the news, if you will, to keep us accurately informed. And what I've observed for the whole year is grandstanding, which is why, my belief, that's why these politicians act up. That's why your Ted Cruz acts up. All right? He wants video to show at home when he runs for re-election. He's not concerned about what happens to the government. And that's something you touched on. I've always felt, all right? And only one person, I regret, I don't remember the guy's name. He was on CNN. But there's a movement out there to destroy the government.
Yeah.
And as I read it, what they want to do is destroy faith in the government. They want people to, any time you mention federal, people won't listen. It turned off. And, I mean, I'm going to use the polls on how do people feel about government as well as the president, but more Congress and the Senate. And
true.
I think there's an effort out there to keep that up. So, you know, I mean, I am the new year, but, I mean, you can tell me where this is wound up.
I would like to ask you a question. Are you aware that David Gregory is not only at risk of losing his job, but NBC is about to shut down Meet the Press?
Pardon me? Wait a minute. David Gregory?
Yeah.
Okay, David
evidently,
Gregory.
Evidently, the choice that NBC sees itself having right now is that it either gets a reasonable replacement for David Gregory, someone who is more of a journalist than an opinion hack, or they'll drop the show. But they're not going to allow Meet the Press to continue as it is.
That they should go after 60 Minutes. They should go after 60 Minutes, too.
That news came out this week. And there have been moments in 2013 when journalism actually did break out.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that of all the journalism that we saw in 2013 and 2012, that what I remember are the moments that journalism broke out and the effect it had, the ripple wave it sent across the media empire, the media universe.
Hmm.
Fox was really hit hard with that. And I don't believe it's true, but if one accepts the notion that MSNBC is media's attempt at equal distribution to counteract Fox, then one has to look at Fox, who identifies itself in court and on its income forms as an entertainment company, not a news company.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
Which is its first defense, and I find that ludicrous, but that's okay. When you have, the kind of reportage that comes out of Fox, you know, that all this beating the drums of the downplay and the destruction of President Obama's presidency and all that stuff is nothing more than manufactured news talk. Okay.
Precisely.
One of the things we have to understand is that manufactured purchased news talk had an effect on the opinion polls.
Correct.
In the first place, it got to more people because they tend on the conservative side to have a more loyal audience. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a larger audience, but they have a more active audience. When somebody says, go to your phone and call, they do. When we say, go to your phone and call, they go, maybe. I'll get around to it. But that's why on the Coffee Party USA radio network, we try to engage people in conversation to come to understand the reality that there are issues that have two very reasonable sides. Okay, the question is, how do we come together for the 10% disagreement we have to achieve the 90% agreement that we have? And I don't know that there is such a place right now on like mainstream media where that can happen. I can tell you that for decades, it used to be Meet the Press. It used to be, you know, Face the Nation. Those have co-opted themselves to a different intention, from unbiased reporting of journalistic news to positional idealism for the purpose of profit. And I think the American people are beginning to say no. Now, the fact that you talk about legitimacy coming from places like Al Jazeera, I would agree with that. I would also put into that RT. I would put into that a lot of internet, radio, and TV, which I think is the big problem that mainstream media has, and that is one of the greatest effects they thought they could have would be the 24-hour news cycle. What they've learned is that we've also created the 24-hour fact-check cycle. And when something happens, we know about it instantaneously. When somebody says something, we can check it instantaneously. So they're having to really become more careful in what they say. When we hear Representative Daryl Issa say something, by the time he takes a breath, somebody knows whether it's true or false. And that's a problem. I've always had a deep respect. I've been doing this little gig for since 1974. And one of the very first things I learned, Joe, was you never say something on the air which you cannot prove. And it's like, you know, they taught us in law school, one of the first rule of evidence in a courtroom is never ask a question you do not know the answer to. In mainstream media, a lot of the play has gone to put it out there and make them pay the cost of bringing it back. By the time they get the truth out, our results will be what we want them to be. People will be banging on Obama. Meanwhile, when we come back and say, by the way, as a point of fact, as a point of reality, what you said was patently false, their response has been overall, no big deal. We're on to the next, you know, hey, it's 12 seconds. It's passed. It's over.
Exactly. You've got to figure it out. I was guessing at it, but, you know, hearing it from you is a lot more comforting. I was starting to think I was crazy.
I know the feeling.
I grew up in an environment. I'm originally from New York City, Brooklyn, New York. And I grew up in an environment that, you know, basically you always had your say. But I was taught in school, I went to public school, but even my friends in private and parochial schools, we're all the same way. You always show respect, okay? You can disagree all you want, all right? Maybe you'll never come to an agreement, but that doesn't give you the right to denigrate the conversation, to denigrate the idea or thought you're trying to put across, okay, by, you know, acting irrationally or making falsehoods, leaving people up in the air. And, you know, I mean, I'm starting to see that very thing in the media, and that's troubling.
Well, it's dangerous. I think the reason it's dangerous is we've proven that we can give a little bit of additional latitude to the fourth estate. However, that latitude has to be earned every day. A lot of people took that and tried to make it a lie. And I was raised under the same, evidently, roof as you. You can disagree all day long without being disagreeable. And if you respect the person, you can respect their position, and all of a sudden you have something to work on. And listen, that 90% is a big deal. You know, I saw a lot of people work a lot of hours over getting 1% so that they could pass, like, I don't know, say the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act or things like that. And they were in my house fighting that fight with my dad. So I think I learned, and my mother was a journalist. She was a journalism professor. And even when I was writing in diaries as a young child of 8 and 10, I had to meet a certain standard. She taught me the journalism code of ethics very early in my life, that my words mattered as much as my, you know, my spoken word was. If I said yes, it was yes. And I had to live up to it as well as anybody else. And in fact, I had to live up to it first. This is a matter to me, Joe, of citizenship. It's not a matter of political ideology or philosophy.
Precisely.
At what point did we decide in America that as citizens we have the right to lie about each other in public with some kind of casual arrogance that defied anyone to call us on the carpet? I don't know when that happened, but I will tell you, as a Kentucky hillbilly born and bred, don't do it in front of me, because I have nothing to lose except my word, and I will protect my word and my integrity with my life. So, you know, it's the only thing you really own. And when media gets away with the kind of stuff that some of the networks have been doing for years now, I always hoped, there was a time when I began to believe it wouldn't be the case, but I'm gratified to see that it is the case, that they're paying a price for their sin. And when we lost places like Air America, it was because of profit, which was never what Air America was supposed to be about. So we get the onset of internet radio and television because if you are a progressive personality, say, on a TV or radio show, and the ownership of the airwaves, supposedly by the people, suddenly comes into the hands of two or three super conglomerates who are profit motivated, and they have a progressive radio show, for instance, on terrestrial radio, and it costs them money because they have to pay those folks because they don't work for free, and they have advertising, but it's advertising which is not in agreement with the corporate standing. So somebody like a Clear Channel comes in and in one fell swoop takes progressive radio off the west coast of America and puts in its place sports talk or conservative talk radio. We have a tendency to believe, rightly so, I think, in the progressive broadcast community that conservative broadcasting overwhelmingly controls the medium. And when we see things like CNN or CNBC or Forbes, or, you know, Forbes or Bloomberg or MSNBC or the what could basically be considered to be opposition to the conservative media giants, there aren't too many progressive voices on the radio waves that have the imprimatur of a Rush Limbaugh, for instance, or a Bill O'Reilly. Okay, but there are those who are willing to stand up in their little sections. One of the things that started this show was we have progressive things happening all across the country all the time. We just never hear about it. So we want to give progressives the opportunity to speak their activism and their activities and their activists. You know, tell us what's going on where you live. What are you doing to make a difference? What are you doing about it? And all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, but over the course of a couple of years, Joe, we had tens of thousands of people telling us what they were doing about it. And I'm not the only one? You mean I'm not crazy? And the problem came from New York 21 to Tennessee 04 to Florida 13 to California 46 to Hawaii 2 to Europe, to Japan, to China, to Hawaii, to Russia, to the Arctic Circle on one point. Little connections were made. Little bitty connections were made with fine silken threads. And when it came midnight on the Pacific coast, everybody was listening to Netroots Radio. And there was a voice for them there. They found a place to speak their voice. On Sunday afternoons, they started talking on the radio to this crazy guy in Tennessee. And we went from our first show having 8 listeners to averaging tens of thousands of listens to our shows each week. That was, could have been opposition research for all I know. It could have been the Republican Party tuning in to find out what they're going to argue about this coming week. But there was a counterbalance being applied. There was not this free-range conservative radio, whatever I say is good, thing going on. And Roger Ailes and Fox News have paid dearly for it. Clear Channel's almost bankrupt because of it. The only reason that they are not bankrupt right now is because of Rush Limbaugh, and the only reason that's true is because he is pulling in enough advertising dollars with what's left of those advertising on his show to pay for the lights Clear Channel has to have on during a show. And it was a shock to me for NBC to come out and say, listen, this is our most honored, valued institution. Meet the Press is an American presence. And we are not going to have the likes of you, David Gregory, anymore. Chris Wallace has put on notice. I was reading today, you know, I always look at the headlines of what's going on around the planet before I go on the air. And conservative radio is taking it in the shorts right now. Conservative television is too. You know, you've got Ted Cruz saying, well, I'm trying to stay out of the politics, and it was a real bad thing that President Obama chose to shut down the nation. He got trashed before he got another breath. And it was on a conservative radio show. I mean, a conservative television show. Yeah, go ahead.
They're playing to their constituents.
They don't have constituents.
And the media, subjugates it. They act in concert, be it deliberate or not. I believe it's not deliberate, but the media, in effect, are being played by the politician for his constituents. He's worried about his job. I look at it theoretically. Okay, if we become a nation of districts as opposed to states, and the media doesn't start in some way pointing that out, we don't have a country anymore. Now, I've done a little reading on history, and I'm not talking about the perennial World War II. Human beings have been around a long time. Governments have come and gone. And there are times in history where the aristocrats wound up in charge after the government collapsed. And you had little systems, and you had to pay your dues, and you had to do what you were told. And, you know, I'm scared that's what they're trying to do.
Why wouldn't they?
Why would the people let it happen?
There's an interesting question. I think the softening up in the ground war on the people was effective. I think that I hate to say this because it's going to sound terrible. The propaganda network started very effectively learning, taking back the lessons of the 1920s and the 1930s in Europe, where they simply dropped a hint and let it live. You know, they put it out there and let other people make of it what they would. And people became, first of all, surprised, then they became shocked, then they became scared, then they became silent. And that silence is still consent. So when somebody puts something insane out there and nobody says anything, like, for instance, I would say Daryl Issa, who seems to think himself above the law to the degree that he can leak, quote, secret information of the United States Security Agency or the United States Security Agenda, and act like it's perfectly okay. And nobody says anything, well, he does it again.
Yeah.
You know, well, radio stations and news stations do this all the time.
Hey, now, would I have, I guess, observed, as I understand it, they are not journalists. They're commentators. Okay? In other words, their job is just to interview someone. They're not there to get facts. I bet if they were, half these people wouldn't show up on the programs.
They couldn't.
If they were doing something good and you could find fault in it and you could answer for it, that's how we can get past all our problems. You know, I kind of like to see about 20 million people be able to find living wage jobs. Now, I know it's a, but I would like it.
Sounds to me like you're a borderline Marxist communist to me.
Oh, I'm definitely a socialist.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Really?
I'm right there. Give a single payer. If you want to get rid of Obamacare, I got no problem.
Oh, man, my radio waves are burning up now. Did you just mention the two words that must not be named?
Single payer.
Single followed by payer?
Oh, that's my what goodness. I want at the beginning. Yeah,
Let's look at this from a slightly different perspective, Joe. 1935.
I remember my history.
2013.
Yeah.
Fighting about 1935. Along comes 2013, or more importantly, 2012. How long do you think we're going to be fighting this part of it? Until... It's interesting that now the other side I saw on the news, I'm going to make your month. The other side recently said, you know, we would be better off than single payer than with this stuff. One of the Democratic senators on the floor said, jumped up on the floor and said, you introduce it, I'll endorse it. Shut that conversation down. But it was said by a Republican on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
I could have sworn that I saw Karl Rove, I can't remember the program, and they were talking about, well, what would you replace Obamacare with? And what he said was something that covers everyone.
Everybody. They said it on Fox News
Yeah. Fox News blocked on my TV. I couldn't watch it if I wanted to. Right?
That's where he originally said it.
He stopped there, and then the commentators, I believe it was Morning Joe, but I won't swear to it.
Well, let it go. There is always that possibility. He does show up there every once in a while.
No. I'm looking at kind of like at the November elections, this coming November. I got to be honest, where I am, I don't really think conservatives are going to do very well where I am. Only because I voted this past November. It's an off-year election with nobody running. You know, county this, town that.
That's where they're going to put their money.
Well, they better put a lot, because when I went to that parking lot, the first time ever in an election like this, it was packed.
Yeah, and it's going to be packed again in 2014.
When they gave the results the next day, all right, it was 80% Democratic wins.
Yeah, but you're not in Brooklyn either, are you?
Pardon me?
You're in upstate, right?
Yeah, state capital. Yeah.
Oh, you're in Albany. Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm in Colony. I'm like in a suburb. I'm a little outside.
Yeah, I know where that is. You're not in Brooklyn, is what I'm saying.
Oh yeah. I moved out here about 30 years ago.
Yeah. That's a pretty amazing statistic for somebody who's living in New York, not in Brooklyn. Wouldn't you agree?
80%
Democratic.
I was really surprised. Really surprised.
2014. The argument that they're putting out now is Obama is such a bad president and Obamacare is so bad we're going to retake the Senate. No, you're not. You're going to lose the House.
Not only that. They're planting seeds of doubt.
Of course.
they're trying to put up a mural, wow, we're going to win this thing, blah, 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 and people
Do you know what that makes me think of? Election night 2012 and Karl Rove's face at 2:38. Or the Senate Republican minority leader who will forever be known as Ditch Mitch, and I'm talking now as a Kentucky native, who has, if Mitch is too much for me to handle, the only place I can look at is Rand Paul. Thanks. I just love you, Kentucky. The simple fact of the matter is that Mitch is wrong. He was wrong before. He led the Senate and allowed one of his senators to try and whip the House, who single-handedly, okay, the Tea Party terrorists in the House shut down the American government and were perfectly willing for it to default. In fact, they wanted it to default.
Yes, yes.
Okay? Now, that was called a 16-day shutdown. And every time I hear a Republican talk about 2014 and we're going to, I just say, I want you to remember something. Shutdown. Because I will guarantee you that every elected, registered, qualified voter in America is going to remember it come November. While you're talking about what you're going to do, we can talk about what you did. And for them to try to spin it as being Harry Reid and President Obama's fault, there's not an American alive that believes that. They don't believe it themselves.
But every time
they say it, I want them to remember. I want them to be told. I want someone to stand in their face. You can do it within 12 blocks of where you live. You can do it on the floor of the United States Senate. Shut down.
Yep.
That's all you have to say.
Well, that together with the debt limit. Okay, I've got some really bad feelings about that.
Well, there are those Paul Ryan and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and others have said that they believe that the president's faking on the next debt limit. Okay, I hope you believe that. Please believe that. Please.
Yeah. Now, the only problem is all of this integration of faith in government, they're using Obama as a poster boy, mainly because he's African-American, okay?
Who is they?
Not him thereafter. It's the public and destroying our trust in it. That's why we can't get an infrastructure bill. That's why you can't get jobs built, right? They whine about the money. No, it isn't. They want us to fail. And if they can kill our credit rating, all right, so much the better.
Well, they also serve a master. And the master are the corporatist plutocrats that are trying so very hard to become government that they can then destroy. You know, I've never been so chilled by anything that any American with a microphone ever said like I have when Grover Norquist said, we want government to be so small that we can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
Have you ever watched Lawrence O'Donnell?
Oh, all the time, sure.
There you go. He interviewed a guy about that. I can't remember who. I remember watching it. And it was like, that's when it hit me. This is not a joke. They are serious.
No. And
they wait for me to die, all right? They wait for my group of people to die, and they just keep going and going.
Yeah.
They got it reined in, and we need citizen paid elections. All right? You got to take away money in politics. It's got to be done.
Well, I think we've had the experiment, and I think the experiment has shown us what we need to know in order to make a correct decision. And the decision that was made in Citizens United was absolutely the wrong decision, as was, for my view, Heller. And as a legal theorist, I can tell you that even if we submit some, let's just imagine neutrality on the part of the Supreme Court, okay, that they're not activists, that their purpose is to interpret the Constitution. And when they interpreted Citizens United, they were wrong. They were wrong in Dred Scott. They were wrong in Loving v. Virginia. They were wrong. They've been wrong. It's not a big problem. They can overturn themselves, or we can overturn them. When the time since Citizens United has hit, even Justice Ginsburg, with agreement from other justices, has said we desperately need to revisit our decision on Citizens United.
Yes.
Okay?
Beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Now, the reality before us is that we, the people, the citizens of this land, are the government. We elect, as electors, those who represent us. They are the elected.
Right. There
and
are
if the elected, if the elected does not respond to the will of the electors, they need to be replaced.
Yes.
And this is the issue that is going to dawn early and loom large in 2014. And it's not our party planks or our platform or our positions or our philosophy or our ideology. It is how are we going to govern the people of the United States of America. And there is a problem that Republicans, conservatives, ultra-conservative, fundamentalists, and Tea Party terrorists have. They're in the minority. And when women started leaving the Republican Party or the Tea Party, the Tea Partiers didn't go to the Republicans, and the Republicans didn't go to the independents. They both went to the Democratic Party. Latinos did not go to the center. They went to the left. Minorities, blacks, did not go to the center. They went to the left. They empowered the left. And they were the ones who were the most likely ones to be negatively affected by voter suppression. And when they were told that they weren't going to be able to vote, that's when my hope in citizenship found a new life, because they came to the streets and they said, oh no, they're going to do it again. And they're going to do it again in November of 14. They're going to understand that we as electors are responsible for our electeds.
Yes.
Instead of the other way around.
Yeah.
And I think that what's going to happen if my fear, to be honest with you, Joe, my biggest fear in all of this, I believe that the Republican Party is in the midst of a self-immolated meltdown. I believe they are beyond salvation by their own hand, and they will demise as a party. I don't want a nation without a two-party system.
I think we
need the voices. I think it's not the Tea Party that will survive, but the Tea Party believes that. The Tea Party has no problem at all in eliminating the Republican Party from American political landscape. But what they don't understand is that won't happen. They won't kill the Republican Party. The Republican Party may kill the Tea Party while at the same time destroying themselves. But they're willing to do that to keep the Tea Party from becoming relevant, because the Tea Party has proven itself incapable of even understanding governance, much less participating in it. And I would hope that the Republican Party or some party like it can gather its political ideology and gather people to say, an Eisenhower Republican, you know, as opposed to a Johnson Democrat, the Republicans are not pushing their party to the left. The Democrats are. We got pulled so far to the right that, you know, it was so hard to be considered conservative that you had to go well beyond to the right fringe to even be considered reasonable in the Republican Party because of the Tea Party. And to stay center, the Republicans, knowing this, pulled the Democratic Party to the right. The failure was the Democratic Party allowed them to do it. And we did not remain under our principles. Progressives had to isolate themselves left of the Democratic Party, which was still right of center. And now that pendulum, which historically, as you say, if you look at the long view, it is a pendulum. It does swing.
Yep.
And it is swinging in a way that could result in a Democratic majority for decades. It is not because of the powerful correctness of the Democratic Party, which is the greatest shame of all. It is because of the insanity of the Republican and Tea Party. Now, I believe that America, I see, it's like, I'm not the only one with that idea. You know, it's like you said, I thought I was going crazy. I was the only one that could see this. I understand that feeling. I felt it too. And I was a politician. I worked in the legislature for 6 years, for Christ's sake. And I just kept shaking my head going, I cannot be seeing this. I do not understand. How is this happening? Under mortality, you know, you get an autopsy. And we looked at the autopsy, and the autopsy said this happened this way. You know, a guy walked onto the lawn of the White House, stopped by the Treasury, raped it one more time before he headed back to Crawford, Texas, and said, thanks, you're on your own, good night. And we are still attempting to recover from that. Now, they will say, oh, sure, blame it on George Bush. Go ahead. When does Obama become responsible? Obama became responsible in January of 2009. If you want to look and carve that away as a timeline, please, by all means, do so. If you want to look at economy, if you want to look at social health, if you want to look at education, if you want to look at national health care, if you want to look at equality for women, if you want to look for marriage equality for LGBT, if you want to look for growth, go ahead. Is he perfect? Hell no. And by the way,
anybody who says that
is second to him because he said it first.
But the media won't. See, that's among the things that upset me. All right, I understand there are problems, but let's lay it out in the perspective as it happened, okay? And that, to my view, what I've seen in the past, inspires the citizens. We pick ourselves up and we move forward. And what they do in Washington is prevent it. Right? They will stop wars. Right now, there are Republicans taking a bow for how well the economy is doing, and that's why we don't need to increase the unemployment limit. Okay? They're taking bows for it, and they had nothing to do with it.
This happened as a consequence in spite of everything they did. The Republicans don't have the right to come near it. Now, American citizens know that. What happened, I think, was somebody said something at a moment when somebody was listening. It was one of those rare intersections when somebody said something and somebody was listening. They heard something, they snapped their head, and they said, say what? Now, there is a limit to reality, okay? And what you just said does not exist there. And it was, again, you know, me talking to you. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, there's two of us. It's not a completely dark room. I lit one match, and all of a sudden, to my shock, there was another match lit. It's not the first match that matters. It's the second one. And in place after place across this country, from Alabama to Alaska, from California to Maine, from Florida to Alaska, people were turning their heads going, wait a minute, hold the bus. That's a lie. I know that's a lie. You know I know that's a lie. Why are you standing in my face and telling me what you know I know is a lie? Now, it's almost, not quite, almost to the point where when their mouth is moving, they're lying. The trouble of that is,
I hate agreeing with you on that, but I do.
The trouble with that is there are many citizens of this nation who believe in conservative values both physically and socially that need representation that are not getting it, who need to come to the table, who have the right to have discourse, to have their positions known, yet they're not allowed to by their own party.
Well,
and, you know, the common statement is, I didn't leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me.
Yeah.
You know, and they're coming to the Democrats not because they have changed their values or their beliefs, but because that's the only place that they can give air to it, that they can actually have a conversation. So you have idiots like Joe Scarborough and the ultra-conservative lies that come off of his show on a progressive network because we believe in conversation. So he has people that irk him to no end, sometimes irk me to no end. You know, you've got people like Chris Hayes who have one view, Al Sharpton who has another, Rachel Maddow who has another, Larry O'Donnell who has another. And all of a sudden, the difference between watching Fox for 24 hours and watching MSNBC, for instance, for 24 hours, is that when you watch 24 hours of MSNBC, you get 9 opinions. You get 9 perspectives on the same problem. When you watch Fox for 24 hours, you get 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I hate. That's what I hate. As much as I'm irked by some of the things I hear on some of the more progressive, less conservative, but I split my time because I, you know, my mama taught me, know thine enemy and keep them close.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I heard it a little different. Keep your friends. Your friends can be at a distance. Your enemies you want right near you.
Yeah. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. But know thine enemy. You know what it is that they're saying, so that you can accurately respond to it. If, for instance, this is going to be a bridge burner, but bear with me for a moment. There are people who say that Edward Snowden is a traitor. There are people that say that Edward Snowden is a hero. As far as I am concerned, before you can legitimately enter that conversation, you really need to understand why each side is saying what it's saying. So that if there is disagreement in theology, we call it apologetics. You apologize or defend your position, okay? And I can have an opinion. I put a big box around it and says, there's absolutely no factual basis in this whatsoever. This is my opinion. My opinion on this is, if I come out and say that it is a dead stone cold fact, that I'd better be able to back it up.
Yeah, right? In the area of the NSA, all right, I've just about written that off as minutia. I'm not trying to make light of it, but what occurred there is a person took information and he wasn't authorized to do it. What they're doing is blaming the federal government for it happening. Now, true, the federal government cuts the checks to the corporations that employ these people. The government didn't do it.
The government
and nobody wants to rein in. They want to save money. Why don't we start looking at all these corporations? $80 billion a year. I was shocked when I found that out. I thought it was about $40 billion. It's $80 billion a year, and it goes up every year.
It's probably, in terms of real dollars, it's probably double that. It's probably closer to $150 billion.
Holy cow.
The nature, okay, what I said yesterday in my diary was, actually, I didn't even do a diary. I did a comment to a piece that Egberto Willis wrote, one of our coffee party hosts here. He said his piece. He got a lot of conversation about it on both sides. And I said, it seems to me that there are two major issues here. One involves Edward Snowden and those who are either side of that. And then there is the NSA and different sides of that. And then a question about democracy and citizenship and both sides about that. The question is, which question is the one that matters? Is it that the NSA stroke government, or is it Edward Snowden and what he did? I was in the military. I was a top secret final clearance holder. I knew at the moment that I was selected for that job that there were certain requirements that I would have to fulfill or face military justice. Okay. In the civilian sector, I retired from the military on a Friday, went back to the same job on a Monday wearing a blue suit instead of a green suit, and did that for 12 more years. Okay. And the rules didn't change, except that the likelihood of me being held under civilian justice was 10 times greater. But because I was a civilian contractor to a military governmental entity, that didn't mean that I wasn't under military justice. Okay? It meant that I had an agreement that I couldn't breach. Now, in one case, you have a Bradley Manning who is active duty military. In another one, you have a civilian contractor in Edward Snowden. And as a result of acts they took while under that security contract, things happened. The question then becomes, were they the right things? Should they have happened? Should they have not have happened? What happens because of what happened? How do we deal with the fact that we know things that we didn't know before? First thing I would say is you've got to understand that there is a security interest in the United States of America, and there are things that citizens simply should not know. And the Snowden thing, if it's the NSA, what the NSA is doing, whether or not we as a citizenry agree or accept that is happening, and if not, what are we going to do about it? That's a conversation I'd love to have, okay? I'd like to talk first about the Patriot Act.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. Don't get me wound up on that.
I see the Patriot Act as the first sinful child of a demon-possessed evil ruler. That's what I see. But the simple fact of the matter is that we have a security agency in this country for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a very good job over the course of history with a few little road bumps. I think that in the farthest slide down the face of the problem, both Manning and Snowden are going to be road bumps. The question that I see as being important is, what are we as citizens willing to temporarily set aside to gain safety and security?
Well,
if this is not...
My take isn't so much what are we willing to give, all right? Yeah, we do have to. But the controls, all right, and the right to recourse, that's, to my view, from when I knew about the Patriot Act, Edward Snowden didn't tell me anything I didn't already know. I'm imagining because he's a young guy. He's in his 30s. He wasn't around in the 70s when I was a credit investigator, loan manager, skip tracer. I worked for private investigators. What they're talking about, phone number? I had books that gave the phone number, the address, the income for the area, population. They were all little codes at the end of the string where the name and the address and phone number were. And you could tell from that exactly what you were doing, dealing with. Now, no, I didn't wiretap anybody, but the very information, they're saying, you don't have a right to have a person's phone number. You've got to be kidding me. The whole world has those phone numbers. You have to pay for them. The books are very expensive. What they've done, they put them on a computer. It works faster. When I was in the field in the 80s for a private investigator, I asked him, I said, you ever think about computerizing? Well, it was just coming in then, in 84, 85, and they wouldn't touch it because they had a system set up. They got the books for like a discount, and they were used to a certain way of working, and it wouldn't change an entire work pattern, okay, and lose the business in between because you have to retrain people. But they're only doing something that's been done before, but it took a lot longer to do. And the thing was, when I was on the phone, someone who's listening. I was not on the phone by myself, okay? I couldn't take anything home with me. You know, they had security, and this was a private investigation firm. This wasn't the NSA. So, yeah, it's that type of thing. It, to my view now, I'm also former military, but I was only in 4 years, Air Force. I got out in, like, 72. I held a secret clearance. Mm-hmm. Now, security clearance, in my mind, trained by the Air Force, is you keep your mouth shut. You know, you do...
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Can you just imagine? I can't. We've got a lot of similarity in our histories, okay? I was a manager of a collection agency that was one of the first nationwide to go online, and that was Visa.
Oh.
So I was there to help code the first auto dialer, okay? And I ran agency before that. So I'm right with you. But can you imagine in the 70s or the 80s, pulling a Manny in a combat theater?
I can't imagine myself doing it.
No, I can't imagine anybody doing it. The simple fact of the matter is that there are things that can get you executed in the United States military. And if you're in a war zone, in a theater of operations, in a combat theater,
yeah.
It happens before lunch. You talk about express service.
I was in munitions, okay?
I remember a defense contractor who is a security analyst who accidentally, not on purpose, accidentally left a hole open that somebody crawled through. He was sent to jail for 35 years.
Yeah.
Okay? He was a civilian contractor with a company that my uncle used to run called MITRE. And he did not do well. Now, the one of the things that we don't talk about so often that perhaps we should spend more time talking about is that, first of all, we lose a veteran every 80 minutes to suicide in this country.
Yes.
And secondly, you can walk off a battlefield at your own expense, make your way to Fort Knox, Kentucky, go into a building and say, I'm a deserter. They give you a piece of paper to sign. You fill it out. They take it, say thanks. You go home. It's happened thousands of times to the point that they have to staff it 24/7. Now, these are for deserters. These are for people who walk off a battlefield. Okay? I couldn't imagine that in the 70s, could you?
No. As a matter of fact,
the reason LTs got shot in the back in the 70s had nothing to do with them walking off a battlefield. I can pretty much guarantee it.
Yeah. Now, if you look at David Gregory today. He had Snowden's lawyer on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad the guy's got a lawyer. But here we go with media coverage.
He needs better than the one he's got.
He tells Gregory that Ed Snowden is facing life in prison if he returns to the United States. Now, I don't know where this guy's getting his information, but every news report that I saw for this whole episode, he's facing 30 years. That's a max. And it's civilian, it's not military. So he'd probably get knocked down to 10 or 15 years. The only thing I want to know, and nobody has an answer, he took this information, okay? Now, they didn't give it to anybody. It's safe and secure. How do you prove that in a court of law?
You can disprove it.
Huh?
You can certainly disprove it.
He's released
a number of documents to the public.
Obviously.
It's not safe and secure. And the government has said, if you don't give it all to us, you don't come back. Because if you do come back, we're going for a capital felony.
Let him bring it all back. Who's to say that it wasn't copied? This is digital.
Nobody
stuff.
I know.
I'm trying to, I don't care for what he did, but in a legal sense, looking at 50-50, okay, you say this. You want me to take your word for it, all right, that the, quote, keys to the Golden Kingdom, unquote, weren't copied. Now, how do you prove to a court that that didn't happen? Especially when you're in Moscow via China.
Coming out of Hong Kong.
He just, thank you very much. I don't get it.
Assange is still in an Ecuadorian embassy. And the reality is that, as you and I both know, that data, whatever it may have been, at the very least is stale because it's been more than 30 days.
Yeah.
However, lives have been put at risk. We don't know that lives have not been. We do know that lives have been lost because of it. And we know that the American military has been put at risk because of it. And I think that alone is something that we need to address in a civilian court because he's a civilian. But I think he needs to understand that, you know, this whole Christmas message thing turned an awful lot of people more toward my side of agreement than the other side because it was completely self-serving. It was egotistical. It was non-substantive. It had nothing to offer except look at me. I am thumbing my nose at you from across the pond.
We have a lot of 20-somethings. I'm not going to say a majority, but there are a lot of 20-somethings out there that, how can I put it, they didn't apply themselves to studying government when you were in school. I mean,
they weren't required to, Joe. They did away with civics a long time ago.
Right. Yeah.
Listen, I hate to do this because I'm really enjoying this conversation with you, but we have to end the show. I would invite you to come back either tonight on our show at netrootsradio.com for Jibber Your Jabber, and we'll continue this conversation. Feel free. That starts at midnight Eastern.
Midnight? That might be late.
Oh, it might be, but it's not so late. It's at netrootsradio.com. Or please come back and join us next week. We'll continue this conversation then.
Sure. Give me that .com again.
Netroots Radio. One
Netroots.
Word.
Okay.
.com.
Got it.
And I'll be
radio.
On from midnight to 2 a.m. tonight or Wednesday night.
All right. I'll get a coffee pot on.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time today. I do appreciate it, and I hope to talk to you soon.
All right. You have a good
night.
All right.
You too. Bye-bye now. Thank you for the conversation. Thank you for the chat. Thank you for all the stuff that's going on. We need to have these conversations. This is a place where those conversations, agree or disagree, can have. That's why we're here. And the question we ask is, what are you going to do about it? Take that with you this week and make an answer. Make a goal for 2014 to be an actor instead of a watcher, okay? This is a participation sport. It's politics. Where you live. That's where it really matters. Coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia for the past 2 hours, I have been the Tennessee Progressive. Thank you for visiting our show today. If you listen to us on replay on Tuesday at 9 o'clock p.m. Pacific time, or if you listen via archive, we want you to know that we're glad you're a part of us, and we hope that you'll join us on our live show next Sunday at 2 p.m. right here on the Coffee Party Radio. I am the Tennessee Progressive. Bye-bye for now.